Who is that? James Brown. On this day, this album, Live at the Apollo, not a break in the album, got number two on the album charts on this day in 1963. The album spent 66 weeks on the Billboard album chart and ranked 24th for all the great 500 greatest hits. And this is an album that James Brown, nobody would back him in this album. And so he backed himself. People don't realize what an entrepreneur that James Brown was. He put his money where his mouth was all the time, whether it was starting businesses to hire black folks or whether it was in his own music business. He created this album on his own. And this is the day the album hit number two on the charts. Still one of the greatest albums of all time. Not a break in the album. Solid music. Solid music. All right. That was part of our day in history, but let's talk about what's happening today in our world. We have in the studio E.R. Shipp, who is, of course, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and journalist-in-residence and associate professor of journalism here at the Global School of Journalism at Morgan State University. Good to have you with us, Shipp, always.
Good morning.
Jackie Wellfonder is joining us by phone, conservative activist and blogger at JackieWellfonder, FONDER.com. Jackie, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And Dr. Lawrence Brown's in the studio, political activist and public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy here at Morgan State University, and just returned from a nice break in the Dominican Republic. We're all a little bit jealous, but good to see you.
That's right.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We're going to cover a lot of issues today, from corporate personhood to the Obama presidency to the NSA, things that came out of the Post about what they really know about us, to what's happening in the Middle East, the Middle East policy, and more. And your ideas at 410-319-8888. So please write to us and call us and let us know what you think, and maybe touch a little bit about Baltimore local politics as well. So let me just begin with this. This is a question I've been wrestling with since last week, and I've talked to a lot of people about this. One day, a young person who I've worked with as an engineer a lot, who I respect a great deal, came into my office, my other office is down in downtown Baltimore, and came in and said, "So why is it that the United States can no longer make lead in bullets in America? Bullets are no longer made in America. They're all not made in China. We have to import them." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Because one of Obama's executive orders was that ended the ability to create lead into to kill lead smelting operations because of what they did to the environment." Well, the reality was that you can't take lead from mines and go to smelting, but lead that's melted down from other products, which is where we make bullets, are still being done in America. I raised this, and then another thing he said about President Barack Obama having doing more executive orders than any other president in U.S. history, and how he's just, going over Congress and killing our democracy. So we looked at that list and said, look, of all our presidents over the last 50 years, actually President Barack Obama has had fewer than President Bush, President Reagan, President Eisenhower, President Clinton, or anybody else. Yet, so the question is, when you look at this, and when you look at stuff about the arguments we'll talk about in a minute about immigration, which we're going to talk a lot about in a few moments, or Iraq being blamed, Obama being blamed for all the mess in Iraq at the moment, there's a lot to fault President Barack Obama about, and we've criticized him on the show on numerous occasions for lots of reasons. But why, the question is, does the attack on Obama, especially from what I think is conservative radio, always have to be underpinned by falsehoods rather than dealing with the realities? You think you can oppose him? And as I do, I think he hasn't gone far enough in many things. Mm-hmm. But Jackie, let me start with you. I want to understand why that has to be the undercurrent.
Well, I think it depends on who you're talking to and who you're listening to. I mean, I certainly understand the concerns. And I admit it raised an awareness reading that article by Sally Cohn and her giving the comparison of how many previous presidents, how many executive orders they had put forth, and President Obama's were significantly less. But I guess for a lot of people on the conservative end of the spectrum, I feel like the levity of some of these executive orders and the possible repercussions, they feel like it's a big concern. And I understand Speaker Boehner saying that, he needs to follow his constitutional oath. I mean, I think all of our elected officials do. But I think it's something we need to tread carefully on because, you know, I think it can send the wrong message.
Ship.
Well, I guess I would ask the question of why wouldn't these executive orders have sent the wrong message when they were being exercised by others? I don't quite understand why those on the left can't be more successful in coming up with the appropriate sound bites to counter the misinformation coming from the right. That's a flaw that I just haven't been able to figure out. Maybe on the left, people are a little too intellectual and make the issue sound more complicated. And a Rush Limbaugh doesn't have to worry about that when he just, you know, spews whatever comes out of his mouth. And then he leaves it for someone else to check out later. It kind of reminds me of when I was starting out in journalism. An older reporter from a tabloid newspaper tried to take me under wing to tell me how to operate in the courthouse press room. And he basically said his objective was just to get in the paper every day. And it didn't really matter if the stories were incorrect, because he said that would assure him of at least another story to correct the first story, and then maybe stories to react to the correction. So he just saw getting it out there, no matter the consequences. And I think that sometimes that's what we're seeing with talk radio hosts, yourself excluded.
At least for
just
today.
Throw it out there, and then they leave it for everybody else to scramble. So you had to go and do research to counter what your producer was hearing from somewhere. I'm constantly hearing things from my cab drivers, and I have to tell them now, excuse me, let's just not talk about politics. Let's not even go there, because there's not enough time for me to explain to you how wrong you are in everything you just said.
Well, you know, Public Enemy has an album that was called Fear of a Black Planet. And I think that a lot of what we're seeing here is an expression of that fear. Dr. Du Bois said that racism is irrational. And I think when you look at the fact that the president passed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which featured a concept that came out of the Heritage Foundation, the individual mandate, and you have luminaries such as Newt Gingrich who were for it before they were against it. You have Romney who passed it and then he was against it. So when you have people that are against the same thing that they were for just a few years before President Obama stepped into the scene, and you have the ugly depictions of monkeys, of the first family as monkeys, you have this nasty undercurrent, somebody's just had a headline, nigger in the White House. When you have all these sorts of like undercurrent, I want to take my country back, from who and why? What happened to your country? You still run it. It's still the same thing. The Constitution is still in play. That's racism. And I think we have to understand that. And like Ship said, learn to be comfortable just naming this is what it is. And even if it's not conscious, you can still have unconscious racism, implicit bias. There's a lot of research on that. And that's where you may not consciously advocate it, but there's still anti-black racism that's still functioning very strongly in our society.
Jackie, what were you about to say?
Well, I was just going to say, I agree strongly with that. I mean, those headlines are deplorable. And just to clarify, actually, because I didn't make myself clear, so I apologize for that. But as far as sending the wrong message, I think, I mean, while I agree, of course, that President Obama needs to adhere to his constitutional oath, I think Speaker Boehner needs to be careful of the message he's sending out by bringing up this lawsuit. Because, like, the impeachment, I mean, for me, I think it's nonsense. And yeah, I get heat for that, but I think it's ridiculous. So I think as conservatives, we need to be careful of, you know, him putting this out there, because I think for a lot of people it can be misconstrued and just viewed as an attack. And believe me, I encourage people to do the research, to not just read the headlines, to not listen to the talking points, and to do the research for themselves. I agree with that as well. They can't just listen to Rush Limbaugh. They have to step out of the echo chamber. And unfortunately, not everybody's willing to do that.
I was
going to
say, most people don't do that. They don't take the time to do the research.
And speaking of stepping outside your echo chamber, because people often identify me with liberalism, though I've never called myself a liberal, but I want to posit this. I was thinking about what you were saying earlier, Ship, and just to comment on this before we jump into immigration. and the issue surrounding immigration. That you were talking about why this can be sometimes a little opposition can be heard in some ways from the liberal side, not being able to be heard. And I wonder if a part of it is because, A, that because of the Tea Party and certain parts of the conservative movement are considered the rebels and all its contextualized layering, rebels, that they're seen taking on the establishment, even though the Koch brothers were very much the establishment. On the other hand, liberals have, in some ways, have bought in so deeply into the establishment politics and world, they end up always defending the establishment, which distances them from the masses of people in America, no matter who they are, because they're always defending stuff rather than thinking about new ways and new directions mm-hmm. America can go in. I mean, I think there's this kind of skewed thing going on, and I think I've just... Think about your ship will go to you first, and then let Jackie have at that as well.
But we see that kind of robust debate in settings like this, and in academic settings at various kinds of conferences by civil rights groups, etc. But it's never turned into something that you can put on a bumper sticker, or something mm-hmm. that you can yell in a soundbite and galvanize people the same way that you can when you say this president is an imperial president, he's overthrowing our constitution, he needs to be taken out of office, needs to be impeached. Those things get people's attention, and particularly if they're already distrustful of him because he is black, that resonates. And some of these other issues that we want to talk about, you know, structural racism, well, that's hard to explain in a soundbite. So we have these bigger issues that we want to see explained that in the media we aren't doing a good job with.
But I do think we could do a better job, to your point, of illuminating the sheer hypocrisy. Because on one hand, if you say he's an imperial president, and then on the other hand, you say, as Peggy Noonan said in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, that he's disconnected, he's aloof. He's checked out of his job. Which one is it? Is he Cool Joe, or is he like, you know, a tyrant that's running around abusing power?
He's all of the above.
When you right,
he's so a super man.
Right, he's a super
super enemy, super
imperial
monster,
president.
Super something, you know.
Right. Jackie, I mean, how do you analyze this?
Well, I mean, I enjoy the robust debate, and I think passion is great, but I think it has to be more than just what's going to get people riled up and what's going to do well on a bumper sticker slogan. I think we have to look at results. I mean, you know, that's why activism is so important to me. I mean, you know, what initiative, like with this lawsuit, I have to look at, you know, what is it actually going to accomplish, or is it just going to, you know, make a plea to the base and make the base happy? I mean, for me, I think we have to look at that with any issue we're looking at. What is the end result? I mean, what are we actually going to accomplish with this? If it's just rallying people and making people happy, well, that's good to a certain degree. But if we're not moving forward and making any progress on the issue that we're actually upset about, well, then what have we accomplished?
What you will have accomplished.
That's something that bothers me, you know, on both sides.
I think with that particular issue, what Speaker Boehner will have accomplished, perhaps, is to fire up people to go to the polls for this midterm election. So that's probably the short-term goal. There's no, he can't seriously be thinking that he's going to win such a lawsuit, but he can fire up his base.
Well, if it goes to the Supreme Court, one never knows. 410-319-8888.
They still live on this planet.
No, we'll talk about corporate personhood in a minute, what that does, because many people oppose the notion of corporate personhood from right to left, and how that's really mm-hmm. kind of exploded into the American scene with recent rulings. But let's go to the phones first. 410-319-8888. And Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, so I'm listening to this. I only caught part of it. Let me say something here. I voted for Barack Obama in 2008. And after his first term, I didn't want to vote for him strictly because his attorney general, Eric Holder. But what I don't like is, so you're saying the Republicans are doing this to fire up their base. There's no consensus for this. What do you think you guys are doing, trying to fire up the liberal base? And I should explain to you and the audience what the separation of powers are between the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and the executive branch. So if Mr. Barack Obama, President Obama, avoids those rules and those laws and doesn't respect the Congress, I say he should be impeached. I'm proud to be a conservative on most issues, and I think us conservatives have to get together and have a grassroots movement.
Bruce, which laws do you think President Obama's broken?
Bruce? Did we lose Bruce?
Wait a minute. Listen. The Congress is given the responsibilities of making the laws. As the chief executive, the head of the executive branch, even if he doesn't agree with those laws, he's supposed to respect them and not try to get around that laws. That's what the Constitution is involved. And I think he should be impeached.
Well, let me ask this question, Bruce, and other people who might agree with you, and I respectfully would submit that I raise questions here that are not liberal or conservative. I'm trying to raise questions that ask questions in a broader sense, and executive orders have been with us since President George Washington, who only did 8 of them, but the man who you consider great, President George Bush, did it over 480 times with executive orders. Barack Obama did much less, and presidents do have a constitutional authority to execute executive orders when it comes to dealing with decisions around the executive branch, especially in certain orders where there could be an order saying that he could, which he won't do, have an executive order in immigration saying that no children will be deported who have families in America. He could issue that as an executive order.
Make it clear that he has not done that.
He's not done that. You know, there are times when he's executive orders you can disagree with those orders, which I think which is an honest disagreement. I mean, liberals were disagreeing with executive orders of President George Bush. But they did not try to impeach him for that.
That's where I think consistency is important. For all of us.
Jackie, I'll take a quick break. I'll let you come right back to pick up that point, okay? We're going to come right back with Jackie Wallfonder, Lawrence Brown, and Shipp as we talk about, Professor Shipp, as we talk about what's in the national news. We're going out once again with more James Brown, the most famous song of that album, Night Train. We'll be right back.
I want all y'all to know, this is my own boogie-woogie, do it just like I tell you. When I tell you to hold yourself, I want to try your best to hold yourself, don't you move a peg. And when I tell you to get it, I want all y'all to try your best to get it. So get ready now, hold yourself. Stop.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the birthday of Pine Top Perkins, born this day in Belzoni, Mississippi. In 1913, and that was Pine Top Perkins' great song, Boogie Woogie. Pine Top's Boogie Woogie. So we are back here with our guests. As we look at the national news, we are joined by E.R. Shipp. Shipp, of course, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in residence, and associate professor of journalism at the Global School of Journalism here at Morgan State University. Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist, public health consultant, an assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Public Policy at Morgan State University, and Jackie Wellfonder, conservative activist and blogger at Jackie Wellfonder, FONDER.com. And Jackie, you were saying what as we were going to break?
Well, I just think our message is important. It's important for us to have consistency within our message. And you're right. I mean, if people weren't upset with President Bush for, you know, all his executive orders, but yet they're upset with President Barack Obama, they need to be able to qualify that and explain what the difference is. And you ought to be able to do it in a way that's credible. Otherwise, I think you're going to look pretty ridiculous.
Let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888, before we jump into immigration issues, which I want to do before Jackie has to leave at 10, 410-319-8888. Leo in Bolton Hill, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Leo Burrows.
And to all of your guests
and
friends in radio land, what's different with President Barack Obama is that he and his wife are brilliant black people in positions of leadership. And, of course, when we're talking about institutional racism, we're talking about members of Congress. We're talking about the Koch brothers. we're talking about a whole lot of rich, racist white men who happen to be, some of them, career politicians. They want him impeached. They want him to do what they say do because he's not acting like a boy, and they're running a plantation politics kind of setup, and he's making decisions. They don't want a black man who's a commander-in-chief. They made a mistake. They voted, some of them, for a second term for Barack Obama, and now they resent it. They're still raising questions about his birth certificate. How stupid and idiotic can that be? You know, the birther issue still comes up from time to time. So what are we dealing with? We're dealing with institutional racism. Hasn't changed. Being led by the Republicans and joined and supported by elements of the Democratic Party as well, who resent his youthful intelligence and the fact that he's black. That's the bottom line.
Well, Leo, thank you. Let me push back on that a little bit. I mean, if some other guests we hear in the studio, they might say and push back that the reception in this modern era that President Clinton got in his ideas as president were hit as hard as it were as Barack Obama. And it wasn't just simply the issue of racism. There's something also going on here that has to do with politics, political life and definition of life, and conservative versus liberal views of where America should go, and that's also at foot here. And is it just that President Barack Obama's black, or is it something that goes beyond that, that it would be whether Barack Obama was Clinton or not, that we still have this kind of vociferous attack against the Democratic president?
Well, again, think of modus operandi, right? When was Clinton called the food stamp president? When did somebody in Congress say you lie in the middle of a State of the Union address? So what Leo is saying is, you know, even if you want to say the vitriol that was directed at President Clinton was intense, and it really was, you still didn't have the level of disrespect at the person directed. When you have somebody who says he's the Kenyan Muslim socialist fascist president, you know, this litany of, you know, things that, you know, that he's an outsider, he's an other, you know, he's not really one of us. We want our country back. You look at the rhetoric, and I think to Shipp's point, the marketing of the sound bites, the reason why the left is behind is because this language has been developed. These code words have been developed for hundreds of years in the United States. So you don't have to say black when you can say food stamp. You don't have to say boy when you can say you lie. So the coding and the terminology has changed, but the game is still the same.
Jackie, let me let you jump in here, because I was also thinking about President George Bush, and I think who was attacked from another end. George Bush was kind of attacked as an idiot, as someone with no intelligence, as the puppet of
he did get a C average, didn't he? Well,
you don't want to look at my high school book, man. That's the last thing you want to look at.
I mean, you could quantify that on some level.
If you looked at my report cards, I wouldn't be sitting here. Jackie, go ahead.
Well, I mean, again, I think balance is important in this issue. I mean, while I certainly take issue with many of the president's policies, for me personally, you know, that has nothing to do with the color of his skin. And I think in some cases, it's easy for some people to assume that's the case. And I mean, I have many black friends within the conservative movement. Believe it or not, they really do exist. And they take issue with the president's policies as well. And it obviously has nothing to do with the color of his skin. But I would certainly never deny that with many people, unfortunately, those racial undertones do exist. And that's why I think we need to be careful with the message we're putting out there. And we also need to pick our battles, and we need to be smart about it.
So, and Shipp, a thought, then I want to switch gears to the whole battle of immigration on our borders right now, and these young people coming in by the thousands to America.
I was just going to say that some of the vicious debate that we've seen over the last couple of decades or so between conservatives and liberals, the religious world and the secular world, the question of values, that had been building. And I think the whole notion of civility has been in decline. And the election of a black man was just the final straw to push the arguments in the direction that Lawrence was talking about. that it becomes very personal, and it becomes mm-hmm. personal in ways that you know are trying to connect with people by saying, this man is different. He is not a Christian. He is black. He's not an American. They really are just saying he's black, but they don't want to say that word. But I agree with you that past presidents have been caught in this vicious debate that we're having on the extremes or from the extremes. It's just that once Obama came into office, there was another element, and that was the racial element.
So let me switch gears here from you all. Then we'll open the phones here. Ron, we're going to come to your call at 410-319-8888, and then the Clarence, the same number, 410-319-8888. But this whole question of what's going on the border now in the immigration, there have been a lot of things happened. There was a report this morning that I heard that talked about how the human rights activists and people who work for children's rights are asking the Border Patrol to allow them to go in because these kids are sick, they're dehydrated, they're seriously ill, and the Border Patrol will not respond, allow them in, that there are thousands of kids coming in, and why they're coming here is part of the debate. What happens to these children once they're here is part of the debate. And it's become really vitriolic when you listen to the arguments taking mm-hmm. place in this country. So what are our thoughts on what this is all about? Jackie, let me start with you.
I think again, it can be another contentious issue, but I think it's important for people to look back and do the research and to think about under the Bush administration and what the numbers were then and what they were now. And I think obviously, I mean, when you bring children into the equation, it's heartbreaking. But I think we need to be realist as well, and we need to think about the people that we have here and the impact it's going to have on us, you know, if we bring these children here, the impact it could have on communities. I believe you spoke in the past about the possibility of, you know, bringing some of these children into Baltimore. So I think it's a very touchy subject because it's when it comes to children, you don't want to see children sick and hurting. But I think we need to be realist about it as well. And if we open the floodgates, we're going to have a huge problem.
Lawrence.
Well, I think that, you know, this has become yet another reflection, another mirror that we can hold up to ourselves as a society and ask ourselves, what kind of society are we? What kind of society do we want to be? And if we do the research, then we see that at the end, the very end of George Bush's presidency, passed along with Congress a law that allowed children, if they were able to, you know, escape some sort of violence in their home country, to be able to stay. And now you have folks that are taking advantage of that law in some form or another. But I think you have to go back even further to policies like NAFTA or even American involvement in these Central American countries that have destabilized these countries' economies and created the sort of influx first for these parents, these children's parents, and now they're trying to bring their children up here to the United States where they are using the cartels and paying them to do that. So I think that looking at the economic destabilization that our country has been involved in, we're behind our policies in many ways, the School of the Americas, our military engagements in Nicaragua and other countries. Our policies have destabilized these countries to the extent where people don't have a chance to eat. There's such extreme poverty. I went to Honduras last year, and even though people are resilient and even though they can thrive in the midst of that kind of poverty, you're still talking about the lack of opportunity. And they want exactly what we want, the chance for our children and our children's children to be a success in this world. And so that's, I think, what we have to look at.
Well, the children are being used as kind of cannon fodder, I guess, in this mm-hmm. fight over immigration policy, border control. President Obama is now in a position where he has to show that he is trying to control the borders. So he's apparently trying to get Congress to give him money to beef up border security. He's saying that, or his Homeland Security Secretary is saying that they are not going to just open the borders to these children. They're going to send them back. They're trying to speed up the process.
The Obama administration.
The Obama administration is trying to speed up the process so that they can return children to Honduras and Ecuador, countries that are not border countries to the United States. They have a different policy than what they have to follow if the kids are coming from Mexico.
Who are immediately deported.
Right. They can be immediately deported. So Obama is trying to stand up to show that he is controlling the borders. He is the commander-in-chief. But at the same time, he wants Congress to address the overall immigration problem and pass the comprehensive immigration bill. That would begin to address some of the problems of what to do with families who've been divided. Some members of the family are here legally, others are not. But Congress doesn't want to do that. That's one more thing that they're holding up because they don't want to give Obama a victory. So in the meantime, the kids are being used. These coyotes, is that what they're called?
The ones who smuggle people?
The smugglers are getting exorbitant amounts of money from people to bring the kids into the United States. They are in poor condition health-wise in some cases. They have been abused in various ways. So we don't want to add to that, but I understand the need to somehow gain control so that you don't have every child from Central America coming into the United States.
Now, I really do want to get to the phones here, but I want to posit this thought. I mean, a couple of them here. One is that, you know, why these children are coming here, what's fueling them, what's underlying all of this fleeing. And I was reading articles last night about, there was a PBS report over the weekend that more and more of these young people, maybe the majority now, are young girls who are fleeing places like Honduras. Another story that was written a bunch of months back, maybe a year ago that I read, that I pulled up, that talked about how the gangs themselves that are plaguing Honduras and Guatemala and Nicaragua and some places in the isthmus mm-hmm. below Mexico, in between Mexico and South America proper, are fueled in part by young people who had grown up in the United States, were brought here as children, but were born there, that were leaders of the gangs here that have helped build the gang movement in Latin mm-hmm. America. So there's all of this mm-hmm. really intricate kind of connections going on about what's mm-hmm. what's fueling these people, fueling people, folks coming up here, that many of them are trying to get to their parents. Others are just fleeing. And what is a response from the United States government? What should it be? Do the kids who do have, can prove that their parents here, documented or undocumented, be allowed to be with their parents? Is that one level of it? President Barack Obama wants to take it away from, the President Bush is the one who actually installed the rule of the law, which I think was an executive order, by the way, installed a law that said that these kids would have to go through a magistrate and have a right to petition the government. That was under President Bush, and mm-hmm. it's actually President Obama wants to take that away and have Congress change it to Homeland Security so these kids more easily be deported more quickly back to the countries mm-hmm. they came from. But mm-hmm. it's the Democrats who are opposing President Barack Obama mm-hmm. from doing this in Congress. So, I mean, there's a complexity here to this. So what... Go ahead, Lawrence.
You know, but this dovetails into our earlier conversation. What Clinton can do that Obama can't do is triangulate. See, Clinton was able to pass welfare reform that the Republicans wanted. He was able to pass other policies that curbed social protection, social welfare, because that's what the Republicans agree with. Now, when Obama wants to pass immigration reform, when he wants to pass health care reform, there's so much animosity. Again, when you look at gerrymandering and the way that Congress has created, and a lot of state legislatures have created, these supermajority racial districts, so that you literally are minimizing the diversity that we have in this country. The political calculation that you speak of, Mark, is one where we're very much racially polarized in the way that these congressional seats are drawn up. So if you're in a super white district, what incentive do you have to work with this president on issues that you supported getting done maybe under other circumstances? And I think that's the reason why we have to confront what is really going on.
So, and Jackie, I'm going to go to the phone here, but I'm just wondering if you're getting any responses to the Twitters you're sending out.
A response to what? I'm sorry?
What you've been writing about in terms of what's going on with kids. I've been looking at Twitter, just seeing what people mm-hmm. Have you seen any responses? I'm just curious.
Well, again, I think it's varied. I mean, I think inherently people are very compassionate towards these children. And also, as she was saying just a second ago, I mean, it's deplorable that they're being used by some of these people and they're profiting off them. So, I mean, I think that's certainly heartbreaking to people. But again, we have to have some kind of balance because we have to look at the repercussions of, you know, unfortunately, we are going to have people that take advantage of the situation. And make it, I mean, especially the human trafficking issue. I mean, we have people that are going to exploit children to try to get them over here for their own personal causes. So, you know, I see both sides of the issue. And I also see Republicans, any Republicans who are willing to, you know, come closer to the middle and work towards immigration reform, they get attacked. But unfortunately, it, you know, it's a heated issue and it's something that I don't think we can overlook. It's something that has to be addressed.
410-319-8888. Let's go back to the phones here. And Ron in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Mark.
Ron, good morning.
Good morning, good morning, guests.
Good morning.
See, the problem is with the Republican Party, they have to realize that when George Bush was president, he handed over the reins to President Obama, and this is why the country the way it is, you know, and You know, they're talking about, to impeach President Obama. They should have been yelling and screaming about impeaching George Bush, you know. And so the problem and the cycle will continue, you know, to happen, you know, especially with racism in America. You know, it will take 100 years for them to figure out President Obama and his strategies. And the way that he operated as a president. And that's my comment. Have a good day, guys.
Thank you, Ron. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Clarence, who's been winning a while as well. Clarence, you're on the air.
Stein.
Good morning, Clarence.
Stein, would you think, Mr. Stein, would you think that it's a good case to be made that every, when you look at it, the problem with the children coming across the border, when you look at it as a cause and effect thing, everything that we do here in America, our standard of living is a contributor to that. Whereas we get the cheap labor in that country for fruit, vegetables, cheap clothing. Wouldn't you, and it's in particularly the drug import, wouldn't you say that the overall factor is, part of it is our quality of life here in America? Thank you, Mr. Steiner.
I guess there are a lot of issues here with the children coming in. I'm going to get one more caller in here so we can wrestle with this before we have to go to break, and then we can talk a bit more after the top of the hour, though, and I'm going to get Jackie's thoughts before she has to leave. One more thought on the air here, 410-319-8888. Keith, you're on the air.
Yeah.
Good morning, Keith.
You know, I think of all of the domestic policies that's facing the United States today, I think the immigration policy is the most threatening policy for our politicians today. And that the reason why they're stalling on this policy, I look at this from two perspectives. One is, I think it's the United States comma. We're experiencing a comma. And the second problem is that this policy is a policy that has to do with the minimization of white supremacy in the United States. We're talking about a policy that's dealing with bringing people of color into this country. Because the future of this country will predominantly be people of color. And our current politicians today are trying to do everything that they possibly can to hold on to the power, because what we're seeing here is an evolution. They brought the black man here against his will. They annihilated the Indians. And now they're trying to keep the brown man out of this country.
So let me pick up what some of our listeners were saying here and what we think. I mean, you know, when I'm reading some of the stories of the kids that came in and why they came here, many of them because of the confrontations they had with narco gangs, being raped, boys and girls forced to deal with sell drugs and just fleeing. And I think we don't understand the terror that these kids are living under. And, you know, you can say, okay, we should let them in, or you could say, no, well, look, that's horrible, but we can let them in. So the question, but that's the reality we're facing. You were about to say what I could see. Ship.
No, I was just going to say that is the issue, and we don't have anybody in Congress who is willing right now, particularly with a campaign looming, who's willing to sit down and come up with some kind of solution. It may be that the resources to assist these kids should come in their countries. Maybe there's something we can do to aid them in their countries rather than arresting them and sending them off to some kind of camp until their legal issues can be resolved. But no one's willing to sit down and try to come up with a solution. I don't think I have an answer. We can all point to what the problems are and what the trade-offs would be if you do one thing or the other. I'm not fearful that we're going to be overrun by children taking over Baltimore or any other metropolitan area. I don't fall into that kind of fear camp. But I do think that you have to have some way to control who's coming into the country and under what circumstances.
Jackie, I know you have to leave in a few minutes. You have to leave by 10, so let me let you come back in here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I mean, for me, I just want to reiterate again the message of consistency, because while I agree wholeheartedly that we need to hold President Bush accountable for his actions in the past, I just hope we'll see that for President Obama as well from the left, as far as, you know, certain policies that are put forth that end up possibly doing more harm than good. But I agree that consistency is important with our messaging, and we can't just blame. And I also think we just need to be careful not to paint stereotypes, because, again, while I agree that racial undertones certainly exist and they're very relevant and they need to be addressed, I just hate for someone to paint me in that category just because that is not me, and that is not necessarily conservatives as a whole either.
That's important, as will be said as well. And I'm curious, but what are your thoughts on what Shipman, we were just saying, the callers were saying about immigration and what you think the responsibility should be, and where do you think the divide is between President Barack Obama and the Republican Party?
Well, I agree that it's unfortunate that, I mean, we see this too often, that people are more concerned about getting reelected than they are actually addressing policy issues. And so I think that's something we need to address by getting quality candidates in office. But, I mean, the thing is, it is an issue, and it is something we need to address. I mean, we are talking about children, so it is important, and it's not something that can just be overlooked.
Well, Jackie, I know you have to run, but we've got a few more minutes. We'll keep you here. And let me go before we all have to take a break and come right back to continue the conversation. Lawrence.
You know, I do think the long-term solution entails making sure we create more opportunity in Central American countries where a lot of these children are coming from, in Mexico where a lot of these children are coming from. We have to look at NAFTA. We have to look at the School of the Americas, the violence that we've imported to these countries. We have to look at our culture, because is what we're doing to these children all that different from how we're setting up these curfew detention centers from the children here in Baltimore? I don't think that there's a big dissimilarity as people may think. We're in a construct where we're about taking away people's opportunity instead of thinking about ways that we can enhance people's opportunity. And I think that is the challenge before us, but it's hard to do when you have jury-rigged, gerrymandered districts, supermajority racial districts that keep us divided and unable to create a discourse that will allow us to achieve that.
So what I've been reading about what's going on within Central America with these narco gangs and their relationship with this country is that in some ways what's happening to these kids in Latin America seems to me is more akin to what happened to children in Central Africa, what happened to children in Bosnia, what happened to children in places where they were used as soldiers, they were used by organizations to be forced to do labor or deal with drugs and violence, or else they would be harmed, killed, raped, or beaten themselves. And I think that's what we're facing. So does that make this different? Is this a humanitarian crisis when it comes to these children, that it's not the same thing as, and you can argue about borders and immigration, which is a huge issue, but specifically these children. I mean, they're not just coming out of a vacuum. I think somebody's also written that saying, look, kids may be also giving messages back to kids in Nicaragua, in Guatemala, and Honduras, and El Salvador, saying, you can come here. If you say you've been raped, you can stay. That's not saying all kids are lying, but saying there's also another synergy there. I mean, there's another level of reason for kids motivating, what's motivating kids to leave there as well. I mean, so there's such a complexity to this. I think that, I guess, if it is partially a humanitarian issue, shipping them back can't be the answer.
Well, I'm pretty sure most people agree that that's not the answer. You need to sort through some of these cases, perhaps. But that's why some of the humanitarian organizations are now becoming so involved in this. There are complicated issues, and these kids are entitled to asylum hearings or some kind of hearings on if they have these issues. But they don't know their rights. So that's why some of the humanitarian people are trying to get involved to find out what the problems are and then decide which track to pursue in terms of the individual cases. But in the long run, we are going to have to face this as an issue that's just is bigger than 50,000 kids coming into the country unescorted since October.
We take a short break. We'll be right back with Ship and Lawrence Brown. Unfortunately, Jackie Will Fonder had to leave. We'll continue discussion for the next top of this hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back as we continue our national roundtable. Don't go away. We are going out here with one of the great ones coming up at this moment. And his songs were just, let me just find out who we're listening to here. I just had it in my head. But here we go. I'm sorry. We are listening to Fats Navarro, who was born on this day in 1950, and Hall of Fame drummer, died at 26 years old. And listen to his songs. He played with the greats, Benny Goodman, Coleman Hawkins, and more. Don't go away.
Yes, stand by me. When this world is a tossing me,
Mavis Staples, Stand By Me, in honor of the great Charles Albert Tinley, who wrote that piece that stood its time. Everybody sings that one. Stood its time. And we went out in my jumbled way. I was trying to tell you that because I was too many things going on one time and I lost one piece. Fats Navarro was not born, of course, he died on this day in 1953. One of our great musicians. But before that, we've been listening to Staples singer Stand By Me in honor of Charles Albert Tinley on his day of birth, July the 7th. We are still here with our two guests in studio. E.R. Shipp is Pulitzer Prize winning journalist in residence, an associate professor of journalism at Morgan State University, Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist and public health consultant, assistant professor of public health here at the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. Jackie Wellfonder could only stay to attend, but she sent a note. She tweeted in, please extend my thanks to Mark and the guests today. Sorry I had to hop off early, but it was good to have her with us for the period she can stay. And you can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Let me read you this thing just in our last bit of time. Switch gears again on you all. And this is something I know you didn't really prepare for too much, but it's something I read it this morning in the Post because it was in the Post yesterday, and I'll just read a quick piece and see what our response is. Mm-hmm. The Washington Post had a four-month investigation concluded that as many as 90% of citizens and ordinary internet users rather than legally targeted foreigners are hit by the National Security Agency. The Post reports that nearly half of the files contain personally identifiable information such as IP addresses, email addresses, phone numbers, and even full names. More disconcerting is how much the agency was able to glean about the lives of U.S. citizens outside of just data. Quote, many other files, described as useless by the analysts, but nonetheless retained, have a startlingly intimate, even voyeuristic quality. They tell stories of love and heartbreak, illicit sexual liaisons, mental health crises, political and religious conversations, financial anxieties, and disappointed hopes. The daily lives of more than 10,000 account holders who were not targeted are cataloged and recorded nevertheless. And that was a quote from the report from the Washington Post, this four-month investigation that was in the Post over the weekend. What's your immediate, and what are our listeners' things about it? 410-319-8888.
What's the source of the information?
This is a four-month investigative piece by journalists at the Washington Post.
The source of the information that the NSA is gathering.
Telephones, social media, internet. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not surprising. It is disturbing, mm-hmm. but I think we're increasingly becoming numb, I think, because so many privacy rights have been practically given away without too much argument since 9/11. That's, we come back to 9/11. We want to be secure, so too many people have been too willing to give up too many rights. I just recently learned that there are some programs that we as individuals can use to find out anything that anybody has ever posted in social media. You could just pop it up on your screen. I could look you up, Mark, and find every tweet that you've ever done. So the NSA isn't the only entity that can do this. We can spy on each other. It's alarming, but it's unfortunately the reality we have right now.
Lawrence.
Well, you know, we trade security for freedom. As Professor Shipp said, you know, after 9/11, that's the trade-off that we made. So we receive what we asked for. And I think that many people are actually comfortable with this. That's why there isn't more of an outcry. Numb, desensitized to this level of surveillance, in part because I think it's been going on for so long. It started off with COINTELPRO, you're spying against citizens of color, revolutionary activists, people who want to see a change in our society. So once you condone it, it's only a matter of time before the national security apparatus is going to be conducting this level of surveillance on the entire society. And I think most people are comfortable with that. Most people are not mad about the government actually spying on us. And I think that's a sad reality.
I mean, I heard Roy Singham speak at the Real News Network conference, their opening conference here a few weeks back. And he is a man who owns a very large software company internationally and works all over the globe. And was talking about, we have no idea about how much information they can glean. This is before the report came out, saying almost exactly what the report's saying, what they know about us, how easy it is to find out about us, how they can track everything that's going on. I think people, I mean, I think this is something for us to be very concerned about. You know, I mean, I always, you know, in the name of security, let's say in Baltimore City, we've all accepted the idea there should be cameras in every corner. Mm-hmm. And there should be a whole division inside the police department. There's nothing but watch these cameras for anything that goes on. Mm-hmm. And because
Morgan has hundreds of cameras here,
mm-hmm. all over
watching
the campus,
everything
that goes
that's
on.
Going on, mm-hmm. And the police department on campus uses that to investigate crimes. Mm-hmm. So if a student says he or she was mugged in the lobby of the engineering building en route to going to a dorm, there's so many cameras around that the police can actually track to see if they can spot you in any of those places. It's everywhere. So
but the distinction I would raise there is, you know, who controls that information and what is the democratic process of ensuring accountability with the way that we're conducting our surveillance?
I hear you, but I'm just saying we're mm-hmm. so accustomed. The
right.
cameras are everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So no one's objecting.
But I mean, maybe we should object. I mean, given what our listeners think at 410-319-8888, maybe we should begin to object, thinking about what is happening when we are gleaning information on tens of thousands of American citizens mm-hmm. that have nothing to do with national security, what that can be used for down line. We don't know who's going to have that information and access to it in years to come, administrations to come, in crisis to come that America faces. I mean, we are, I think, everything, we use this little iPhone or whatever phone you might have all the time, and you know, every time you use this, I mean, the whole thing about the argument going on in Israel right now when these three young Jewish kids were killed mm-hmm. was that the police were not on their game because they could have found the kids mm-hmm. because the phone was on. They could have located after he made the call. Mm-hmm. And so that we're constantly under surveillance. And I think that it's something that, I mean, it concerns me a great deal about what.
But what are you going to do about it?
Well, I think we have to talk about it. We have to raise the issue. We have to say to our congressmen and senators, why aren't you investigating this? Why aren't you setting up some laws and barriers between us and the federal government and what you can see and what you can't see, what's allowed and not allowed? I mean, that's what I guess I'm get so concerned about.
I hear you. I'm equally concerned. But if the NSA collects data in the name of security, at some point, maybe somebody should determine that this stuff is not relevant. But who's going to do that? I don't know. I don't see an answer here. We either have to say we're going to take the risk, the pre-9/11 risk, and I don't think anybody's willing to do that, or we're going to have to put up with some kind of intrusive surveillance.
I agree.
I don't agree. I think we should. I think people should be screaming from the rooftops. This is unacceptable, and I think that's probably the problem with. I think maybe the liberal establishment is that, not putting you all in that category, but the liberal establishment in that they are not speaking up about this. They're going along with it because it's the Democratic administration in the White House. People are not standing up to it, and I think that's a real danger. If this was George Bush, the Democrats would be screaming, but they're not. But you know, I mean, that's a problem.
Well, the outrage about being under surveillance all the time is not limited to left or right, I think. People
no, I agree.
Who are, believe in our traditional sense of liberty should be upset about this. But they are more concerned about being safe
security.
From terrorists.
I guess right. I don't feel that. I think really, even at our airports, it's overkill.
Particularly when I have to take my shoes off. It's definitely overkill.
Let's see, one thought from a listener before we have to roll it. 410-319-8888. And Justin in Laurel, you're on the air. In Laurel, excuse me.
Hello, yes. I just had a comment, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about the spying and the NSA and the collection of information that you were talking about a few minutes ago. It's really interesting to me to see a change or how people perceive or view this between generations or different people. To think that before 9/11 we weren't being spied on or our technology wasn't evolving to the point where sharing our information and becoming less private is becoming a necessary tool for us to evolve technologically and to become a better, stronger community. But some people, or I guess, it's becoming more and more available for everybody so that people are saying, oh, well, we can see that, you know, they're spying on us or the NSA is taking and collecting this information, when in actuality it was probably being collected by other entities and by them before that. And going forward, it's going to continue to be collected. And it's something that I think if we come to grips with and at the same time, we grow as a group together through sharing this, we can create more integrated social applications and better responsive technology. Because as the technology grows, again, it's going to become harder and harder to maintain your security and personal information. And
right. That's
just a reality of technology.
But I think his point about the generational response is key, because I think that's the very reason why I'm skeptical that there will be a backlash, a real backlash, because I think young people today are so used to sharing everything online via social media, via multiple apps on smartphones, that I don't think that there's, instead of a retreat away from a lot of this technology, there's actually more and more of an embrace of it, regardless of its downsides. And I actually am becoming more and more of a Luddite, you know, and thinking about how we need to disconnect, disengage, because we're becoming more and more, you know, moving towards that matrix that the Wachowski brothers talked about.
That's why I was meditating on my hammock all weekend long. 410-319-8888.
I'm surrounded by old guys.
Oh. One last thought. Judy in Baltimore, you're on the air before we have to break. Judy, you're on the air. Hi, Judy, you there? Can we pot her up? Judy, you're there.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, great. The one thing I want to say is that we talk about NSA having data. Also, Facebook owns your data. Instagram owns your data.
That's
whatever
right.
You post out there is available not only to governments for their security needs, it's available to private companies for their marketing needs. And since Hobby Lobby has come along and said that they don't want to provide women with birth control because it's against the corporate's personal value system, what's to say that now they can't go back through your data, determine that you had an abortion in the past, and therefore deny you employment? this could get into a really ugly situation. And I think if we don't get involved now to put some kind of silos around information, that we're never going to get this under control at all. And that people, I mean, I don't put my picture on my resume, but I don't need to anymore because they can go online and find out more about me than you ever want to know.
Right, I'm not so laughing at you. Thank you, Judy. I'm laughing with you because I think that's a great way to end this conversation. And we really do have to think about it. We need to come back to this, take a look at this. I plan to read that entire four-part investigative series, that investigative series in the Washington Post, and see what they're saying. Connie Whiting, just last thought here, wrote in on her iPhone, R.E. President Obama, whatever happened to those loyal patriots, quote-unquote, whom, when they could no longer defend W's policies, cried respect the office. Interesting. Okay, that's from the other side as well, from whatever side you want to mean, not the Democratic side. And we want to thank you all here for being with us today. It's been a really interesting conversation. Ship, always great to have you in studio.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking your time once again today. And Dr. Lawrence Brown, always great to have you here. And thanking Jackie Bell Fonda earlier. And we'll take a quick break and come back and meet the young people from the intersection. So do not go away. And I think we are going out with a little bit of Louis Armstrong. The great Louis Armstrong passed away on this day in 1971. And, of course, we know he's one of the founding fathers of modern jazz, Louis Armstrong.
Da 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 da